When we talk about networks in our time, it's often about social media networks. But our next guest reminds us that humans set up connections and networked with each other eons before Facebook or Twitter moved a single electron. And Neil Ferguson says the tech leaders of today could have used this history lesson before they set up their networks. Neil Ferguson is journalist and historian and prolific author. He's written more than a dozen books, has given widely viewed TED Talks and lectures, and is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and a visiting professor at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Neil Ferguson, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Exchange. Jeff.
Good to have you. The book is called The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from the Freemasons to Facebook. And I wonder if the political events of 2016 gave birth to this book or maybe accelerated its gestation.
It was certainly conceived before then, but there was a kind of impetus to write it as I saw not just the presidential election unfold, but also the Brexit referendum. You can tell from my funny accent that I'm British, and in some ways, Brexit was a curtain raiser for Trump. And in both cases, social networks played a decisive role, and most professional political commentators underestimated the importance of those social networks. What the book tries to do is to say it's not an entirely new world that we live in, because networks predate technology, but the technology has greatly increased the scale and the speed of the networks, and that is a game changer for all of us.
Did existing networks not understand social media networks, or vice versa, or both?
I think there was a bit of both. I mean, I think on the side of Silicon Valley, there was a certain naivety about what was happening. People at Facebook greatly underestimated the risk not only of Russian infiltration of their content, but also of the risk that Trump would win. And it would turn out that he'd won significantly because of their assistance. So I think that was politically naive. Silicon Valley was full of people who basically lean liberal, and their heads exploded when they saw the result of the election, and exploded again when they realized that they'd had a pretty big hand in Trump's victory. I think on the other side, people who have grown up with traditional media, particularly television, failed to see that Facebook advertising is a far more powerful tool than traditional TV political advertising. And so you had campaigns, not only Hillary Clinton's, but the campaigns of other candidates for the Republican nomination, basically running on the technology of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, expecting to succeed. Anybody who adopted Facebook advertising as a primary tool in their campaign was able greatly to force multiply. And those who didn't, and I think this really was decisive, lost out because they didn't have that targeted tool that Facebook provides, extraordinarily precise in its targeting because Facebook knows so much about its users, but also something you can constantly tweak every time you test an advertisement out. You see whether it works. If it doesn't work, you tweak it. This is an incredibly powerful tool. The Brexit campaign understood the power of the tool in the first half of 2016 and the Trump campaign in the second half. And that did change the nature of democracy, in my view, in ways that, unless you have a historical perspective, it's hard to see.
It really surprises me up to a point, because political leaders have been so savvy for so long about finding voters. I mean, complete in America with drawing the districts to get the people they need. And so it seems like a big blind spot that they would not figure out how to find the people they need through new media.
I think one of the things that happened on the Democratic side was a certain complacency, because Barack Obama had been the first candidate to employ the internet in an effective way in a presidential election in 2008, and did it again pretty successfully 4 years later. Democrats assumed that it belonged to them, and they underestimated the possibility that, of all people, Donald Trump, apparently as unsophisticated a person who'd ever run for the presidency, he might know how better to use it. And Brad Pascal, who ran the digital operation, Steve Bannon, who came in late in the day, but pretty effectively, they understood how to use these tools. And the people running the Democratic campaign didn't. Indeed, if you read that book about Hillary Clinton's campaign Shattered, one of the striking features is the extent to which this very professional political group, many of them with experience dating back to the 1990s, missed what a huge game changer social media had become. They also failed to see that it was far more important in 2016 than it had been in 2012 or 2008. And I remember as I was writing the book, I was looking at a very simple measure. Who had more followers on Facebook and Twitter, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? And Trump's advantage on both platforms was just enormous. And it was one of those things that told you that the polls might be misleading and that Trump actually had a pretty good shot at winning. And I've found that it's extremely hard to persuade professional political pundits or political scientists here in academic life at Stanford that that's an important measure. Many people find it quite hard to update the operating system on their laptop. You may know people who put that off. I think in the same way, a lot of us still haven't updated our political operating system, and we still act like it's the 1990s, and it's not.
Neil Ferguson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from the Freemasons to Facebook. So and it's interesting here because you think of the Internet and its use as a consequence of weakening central control, not a cause.
That's right. It's a very common mistake, and one encounters it here near Silicon Valley all the time, to think that technology drives history. This is what is called technological determinism, the notion that we invent the personal computer and the Internet, and the world of politics then changes. But what I try and show in the book is that that's not always true, and that sometimes it's a change in the world of politics that leads to the technological innovation. Actually, all the major technological innovations going right back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution came from networks of intellectuals and inventors who experimented with new technology, whether it's the steam engine or the personal computer. And as they experimented together, they came up with things that worked, things that didn't work, and through trial and error, technology advanced. The critical variable is whether a political system allows that to happen. In the 1970s, when many of the major breakthroughs that led to the modern internet happened, and when some of the key software companies like Apple and Microsoft were established, a big difference between the United States and the Soviet Union was the fact that in the U.S., essentially the Department of Defense let the people in California just do their thing. There was almost no interference in the experiments that were going on the West Coast that ultimately produced the internet. Whereas in the Soviet Union, a much more centralized political system, the attempt to build a nationwide computer network failed, mainly because the people in Moscow cut it off, regarding it as an expensive and probably pointless experiment. So the key thing in the United States was the decentralization of the political system, which allowed research and development in California on government money, on money from the Defense Department, to go off in a direction that I suspect nobody in Washington was giving any thought to at all.
So the issue of decentralization versus hierarchical networks, I mean, does one disseminate information faster than the other? It seems like decentralization certainly leads to innovation potentially faster.
Correct. What I argue in the book is that most innovation comes from decentralized networks, and that this is really the key to everything from the Reformation in Christianity to the Enlightenment to the Industrial Revolution, and even to the great political revolutions. The innovation tends to happen where there are a whole bunch of like-minded people conversing, exchanging, swapping ideas. The problem with that model is that it's not very good at defense, or defense, as you say, in the U.S. And that means that any network can be both creative and vulnerable, very easy to hack. Defense, I should say, tends to benefit from hierarchical structures. And that's why in any army, the guys down at the bottom, the grunts, can't contradict the people further up the chain of command. If you want to do defense, you need to have a hierarchical structure. It needs to be absolutely clear who is in charge and who is obeying the orders. Now, that kind of a structure isn't very innovative when it's applied in the realm of politics. Very centralized political systems, very hierarchical political structures tend to be rather static, but they're quite secure. And that's the big trade-off in human history. We need the creativity of the distributed network, but it's vulnerable to attack, so we need some hierarchical structures in order to make sure that we can defend our organizations.
And in the example you give, I mean, it's an excellent example, I would think, because you can't have people freelancing a lot in the military because that ends up with people dead and battles lost and wars lost.
Exactly. If you saw the movie Dunkirk, one of the great military disasters in British history, but a successful evacuation of a defeated army from the beaches of Dunkirk. If they'd all had smartphones and been texting one another or messaging one another, hey, this is a total disaster, what are we doing? Morale would have collapsed and the operation would almost certainly have failed. One reason that wars like World War II were possible, and remember, tens of millions of young men received orders to go and do incredibly dangerous things, and a really high proportion of them died as a result. It was possible because the technology of that time made any kind of networking very difficult. The most you could do was write a letter home saying, "Dear Mom, I'm in some place," and you wrote the place name down, and then the sensor would delete it. This is a very, very centralized system of command and control. And it would be impossible, I think, to run an event like World War II with the technology that we have today, because the soldiers would all be on their smartphones. They'd be sharing images. They would be passing both true and false information around. In wartime, fake news tends to run riot, but it's controlled by censorship in the mid-20th century. Today, the fake news just spreads like wildfire because everybody has their own very powerful computer in the pocket.
Neil Ferguson, our guest on The Exchange, historian, author, journalist. His latest book is called The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power, From the Freemasons to Facebook. There are six rules of networks you outline here. Number one is birds of a feather flock together. On that basis, should polarity in society surprise us?
Well, it shouldn't, although it has surprised us. I think it was Mark Zuckerberg who thought Facebook would produce a global community. This is part of a long-standing Silicon Valley argument that if we're all connected, everything will be awesome. And that was, I think, naive, because all of history shows that even relatively small social networks tend to self-segregate or polarize into opposing clusters, whether on the grounds of ideology or some other variable. We human beings do tend to divide rather than hang together when we're in a social network. And there was a lot of research going all the way back to the 1970s that showed this, and that all got forgotten because the Kool-Aid that was dispensed in Silicon Valley said essentially, when we're all linked, when we're all connected, somehow that's just going to be great. And I mean, I remember believing that for a while. And it was only when I started to think historically and look at what had happened, say, when the printing press arrived in Europe, that it dawned on me that that might not be what happened, and that what might actually happen would be that we would become more divided. I think polarization predates the internet. We already had quite clear political polarization in the United States, but it has got worse. And I think it's very clear that platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube encourage polarization because the algorithms, as you well know, as your listeners well know, direct things to you that are like the things you already liked. They send things your way that you're likely to engage with. And that means the emergence of echo chambers or filter bubbles, if you prefer, in which we tend to hear more of the same, and that confirms our existing biases. And it often moves us further out along the ideological spectrum. We hear less and less of the opposing view and more of the view that we agree with. So I think, although polarization predates the advent of online social networks, social media online has definitely made the problem worse.
Rule two of networks, it's a small world, 6 degrees of separation and all that. Does this mean that the networks to which we consciously belong are not very far away and, in fact, may actually share members with networks we are not part of?
Yeah, it's a funny phenomenon, the small world phenomenon. The world is getting smaller all the time. Everybody knows the 6 degrees of separation idea, the notion that any two randomly selected humans are just six steps apart. You can get even to Monica Lewinsky through just six steps, maybe less if you know Bill Clinton. But on Facebook, it's actually less than 4 degrees of separation. So the more than 2 billion people on Facebook are just under four steps apart. I think that shrinking of the world is extraordinarily important because it explains why we say, usually once a month, gee, it's a small world. People show up, and it's surprising. People we knew perhaps at high school suddenly appear in the most unlikely place. And this is because we are extraordinarily well connected as a species. And it's not just that we're well connected to our close friends and family, but there are these weak ties to distant acquaintances that connect us to people that we don't know at all. So it's through the people you know slightly, that these casual acquaintances or people that you see only occasionally, that you are connected to a vastly larger number of people than you have in your contacts list.
So rule three, it's network structure that determines what goes viral. We've already talked about hierarchical versus decentralized network. I mean, is decentralized the way the world appears to be going?
I think it is not entirely a one-way street. In some ways, it feels as if the world is becoming more decentralized because more than 2 billion people are all in a social network and therefore can post whatever they like. On the other hand, when you look at network structures, they're actually surprisingly hierarchical, and that's because of something called preferential attachment. When you join, say, Twitter, the people that you're likely to follow in the first few weeks of your engagement will be the people who already have a lot of followers. We are much more likely to follow Donald Trump than Neil Ferguson as new Twitter users. And that's why the big social networks are quite hierarchical in their structure, with some nodes in the network having an enormous number of connections and a great many having very few indeed. I think the network structure point is important for another reason. We tend to think that stuff goes viral if it's cool or shocking, but actually sometimes things go viral just because they enter the network at the right point. If an idea gets retweeted by the President of the United States, it's clearly much more likely to go viral than if I do it. So it's not the inherent content of the idea that matters. It's the person who's transmitting it through the network.
Neil Ferguson, again, our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from the Freemasons to Facebook. Here's a call from Tony in Talent. Welcome.
Yes, I would add that some might prefer to read Neil Ferguson than Trump's twits. So, Twitters.
Yes, hoping.
The question I had is about, I read recently your critique of Angela Merkel and what's happening in Germany, and as you describe it, her disastrous decision to open the borders to Arab refugees, or so-called refugees, as you put it, the mutter of all bad decisions. And that seems to fit nicely with your tower and square theory. She's in the tower, and the folks in the square are having their voice, and she might well be out in the next few weeks. Italy might also be in the same situation, I understand.
Okay,
I was born in Wolverhampton, so, you know, I voted for Enoch Powell, so this is 50 years since his speech, so this has been something that he was very prescient about all those years ago.
Yeah, we could go for quite a while on just Enoch Powell alone, but let's focus on Angela Merkel at the moment.
Tony, I think the framework is extremely helpful in the sense that decisions about migration policy tend to get made in the tower. Angela Merkel was certainly the most powerful woman in Europe when she made the decision to completely change German immigration policy and effectively throw the borders of the country open. Around a million people took advantage of that, one of the most extraordinary influxes in German history. But in the square, in the political square where ordinary people express their views, there has been a very strong backlash against this decision. And I think it's not at all surprising. Indeed, I think it was very predictable that this great surge of migration would have a whole series of political consequences, including, by the way, Brexit, because I think a very important reason why many people switched to voting for Brexit was just watching what was happening in Germany. I can remember being asked in pubs in Britain before the Brexit referendum, hey, that million people they've just let into Germany, if the Germans give them German passports, can they come here? That question was an extremely good question, because the only honest answer was, under the existing rules, yes. So I do think the migration issue is going to be one of the ones that drives ongoing political disruption in Europe. And you're right to mention Italy. Elections are coming up there. Pretty much anywhere where there's an election happening these days in the developed world has immigration as an issue. And pretty much anywhere, social media becomes a weapon in the hands of the square, ordinary people in social networks against the tower of political elites.
I want to come back to the six rules of networks and let this skip to the final one because we're running out of time here. But you say that networks are profoundly unequal, which is going to surprise a few people who thought that, wait, if I'm on Facebook, I have an equal opportunity to make myself heard.
Yes, this notion that we're all netizens equally empowered to speak truth to power is a very attractive one. But remember, there are two kinds of people in cyberspace. There are the users and there are the owners. And unless you have some Facebook or Google stock, you're just a user. And the real concentration that one sees, the real centralization that one sees in Silicon Valley is the centralization of ownership. I think it's really astonishing the huge fortunes that have been accumulated. Most of the richest people in the world now are people who made their money in technology, and they made it by hanging on to really big portions of the equity of the companies that they founded. The rest of us are just users. And we are, I think, naive. We think that these things we use are free. And what in fact is going on is that as we provide our data to Mark Zuckerberg for free, we are not just the users, we are also the product. And the real users are the advertisers who pay Facebook for access to the data that we gave Zuckerberg for nothing.
You made a reference earlier to the Reformation and the printing press and the fact that information was able to travel so much faster once Gutenberg's invention was out there. So there have been previous upheavals. We were reminded recently in another book suggesting this might be a modern renaissance in the offing. But the larger point being, I mean, so do we just wait for humans to calm down and get used to the new technology, or is it going to take a little more effort than that?
I think the lesson of the 16th and 17th century is that when a new communication technology makes networks bigger and faster, then there's a process that is really quite dramatic and prolonged. And in that process, polarization can become more serious and crazy ideas can go viral. So I don't think this process is over in our time. The good news is that it's happening faster. What took 130 years back then is probably only going to take about 30 now. But I expect a decade more of polarization before things begin to calm down.
All right. It's a really interesting book, The Square and the Tower, Networks and Power from the Freemasons to Facebook by Neil Ferguson. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff.